Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Will Murphy, the news director for WFIU. And today we are very pleased and honored to have as our guest Amartya Sen, 1998 Nobel Prize winner in economics. He's now the Lamont University professor and professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard University, and was until recently the master of Trinity College, Cambridge. He has a number of publications, to put it mildly, just to list his many academic accomplishments and honorary degrees and awards would probably take the entirety of this program. So I'll leave it to those who wish to go to his websites or the Nobel sites, wherever they'd like to go to find out his publications. And we'll be talking about that in the course of the program, of course. Professor Sen, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I should note that Professor Sen is here on the IU campus in Bloomington as part of the Patent Lecture Series. Now, you are known as a person who brought a social voice to economics in the 1960s and 70s with social choice theory and advocating for the poor. You've been very invested in Oxfam. We'll talk about that as well. But perhaps we can begin just with a discussion of where it all began. You were born in 1933, and you are the son and grandson of academics. Your
That's
father
true.
Was a professor of chemistry, and your grandfather, if I recall, was a professor of Sanskrit and
That's
Indian
right.
history. And so it seems like you're to the manor born, as it were. Born, in fact, on a university campus, if I recall.
That's also true.
Now, one of the interesting things that crops up when one looks at your life is that your life was influenced at an early age by Rabindranath Tagore, the great Indian scholar, musician, poet. And in fact, I read on one site that he was responsible for your name.
That's true.
Can you tell a little bit about growing up where you did and your influence from this man?
Well, yeah. You know, Tagore, of course, was a very successful literary writer, still tremendously remembered in India and Bangladesh. I think has the distinct honor of having written the national anthem of two countries, the Indian national anthem as well as the Bangladeshi national anthem. Both are songs of Tagore. But he was also a great educator and had a strong voice on social issues, at taking a very global view of culture and yet quite proud of the subcontinental, the Indian and the Bengali heritage, all of them. So, and he also started the school. He was very unhappy with the traditional schools that existed, either of the kind of old Indian variety or of the new British-made schools. And he started a really progressive school, a co-educational progressive school, to which my mother went as a student at the beginning of the, towards the beginning of the century. And I went to school much later there. And that was a school which made one very aware of the existence of civilizations outside what we saw in Bengal and India. And we read not just about the European civilization, the British, the Italian, the French and German and so on, but also Chinese and Japanese and Thai and Indonesian, Asian generally, and also quite a bit about Middle East and Africa. So that we had a very general grounding. It was school with very little emphasis on doing well academically. In fact, we were always slightly ashamed to do well academically, as if there was some kind of failing.
I remember that there's a quote you cite of a professor saying to you of a fellow student, she's a very serious thinker, even though she gets good grades.
That's right. it's one of our teachers in my school said, you might think that she doesn't think seriously because her grades are so good. But in fact, she is quite a serious thinker. So I think that more or less summarized, I think, the way the school was there. I loved it. And I think some of that, the impact of some of that thought was strong. I remember spending quite a bit of time thinking about one of Tagore's lines, one of Tagore's statements. I think it occurs in a letter saying, whatever product of world culture I enjoy instantly becomes mine. So it's a kind of possession which is at one stage quite possessive, that, you know, you can't say it's just yours. Shakespeare is not just your tradition. It's mine because I like it. At the same time, being quite interested also in Indian culture and so on, which he was. The whole family was very involved in Sanskrit education. His parents and grandparents were also very involved in Persian and Arabic studies. So there was a kind of big background. And at one level, I think in one of his Oxford lectures, he said, I come from a confluence of three different heritages, the Hindu, the Muslim, and the Western. But he also went beyond his own background in really enjoying extraordinary things like Japanese music and so forth. So there is a catholicity which I found very, very appealing.
Now, as you begin your studies, you think of a number of different disciplines you might go into. Sanskrit was one of them. Physics, I believe, was one of them.
Math particularly.
Math as well. And you end up going with economics. Two questions come to mind. First of all, what was it that was attractive to you about studying Sanskrit?
Well, I think Sanskrit is a fantastically interesting language. Of course, you know, it has a 4,000-year history. And the forms change. The Vedic Sanskrit of the second millennium B.C. and the kind of epic Sanskrit of the first millennium B.C. and then the classical Sanskrit of the first millennium A.D. are quite distinct. And so it gave a kind of range of education. Sanskrit also is a very well-organized language. It's a tremendous training in systematic thinking, classificatory device. The great statement, which I remember moving me a lot, is one of the grammarians saying that basically all knowledge is classification. And certainly the Sanskrit has always did that, you know. Six ways of admiring someone, 54 ways of praising people, 60 different positions in making love, and so on. So all these are very numerically categorized. And of course, Panini in the 3rd century BC was the first, I think, recognized the world over as the first systematic study of languages and phonetics. And Sanskrit, by the way, is often not recognized. That's not the old name of the term. Sanskrit means reform. So it's the reform classicalized language, which really Panini played a major part in starting that. So I found that both quite thrilling to go back 3,000 or 4,000 years and see how all that's proceeding. And some of the verses I found very moving. And yet, I think there was a kind of logical discipline. And that was combined with my education in maths, was getting me somewhere. And happily for me, some of the mathematical treatises, very often forgotten because Indian culture is often thought to be so religious, overlook the long history of skeptical thinking, mathematical thinking. Mm-hmm. I mean, between the 4th, 5th, 6th century, 7th century AD, there was this real flowering of Indian mathematics, Aryabhatta, Brahmagupta, Varahamihi. It was wonderful to read these in Sanskrit. Both you got kind of what precise Sanskrit could be like, and really interesting propositions in maths, and in the case of Aryabhatta, also great doubts about this is 499 AD, arguing why there's no way of arguing that the sun goes around the earth. Much more plausible the other way around, and indeed then went on to discuss the diurnal motion of the earth. And so that way, for 499 AD, it was pretty early thought, and also discussed in that context the primitive theory of gravity, namely that if the Earth is churning, why are things not thrown out? And then there's this lovely discussion which he has and then his follower, Brahmagupta, follows, namely that all objects attract each other. And since Earth is a large object, it attracts smaller objects like us much more strongly. So there was a kind of, I mean, later on when I was a student in Trinity and was imbibing the air of Isaac Newton, it was wonderful to think that in a very primitive form, that thought has occurred earlier. I think Aryabhata might have been able to say something to Newton when he was somewhat surprised why the apple fell down to the ground rather than moving in any other direction. So I think all that connection was important. By the way, my choice in applying to Trinity when I went eventually to Cambridge after doing my first bit of college studies in Calcutta was not unrelated to my interest already in physics and Isaac Newton and so forth.
Makes sense. But you eventually opt to pursue economics. What was it that nudged you in that direction?
Well, I think several things. One, of course, the economic problem is very big in India, as you recognize. It's wonderful to be inspired by the intellectuality of the thought, but it's also impossible to overlook the massive extent of poverty and the misery of so many people's lives, miseries that to a great extent relates to their economic deprivation. So that made economics a general subject of interest. It occurred again and again whenever one would. I used to go around when I was a small child in the villages around Shantiniketan, which I referred to, where I was also born, where my grandfather was teaching Sanskrit. But that area is a very rural area. It's about 100 miles off Calcutta. And it's all around their villages. So as a small child, I used to go around everywhere. And you saw a lot of poverty. And question will often come that why is it the case that they're so poor? And then when I was nine, came the Bengal famine, in which...
millions died.
3 million died, but that was my estimate. Some people have disputed that, suggesting it's more like 2.5 million. But whatever it is quite large. I've seen also estimates on the other side, 4 million. It's not by any means the largest famine. The largest famine I studied was the Chinese famine of 58-61, in which 30 million died. 29.6, I think, is the estimate that's generally accepted now. But it was a very large famine. So that also made me think, why do people die? And, you know, why do famines occur? Especially since there was some evidence there was a lot of food around. And that made me write a book. Many, many years later, the famine was, early part of 43, ending in November, just about my birthday, my 10th birthday. It was finishing up. And in 81, I published my first book on, my first paper on famine, I think, was 73. But 81 was when I published a book on famine. So it had been a present with me for a long time. It played a part in making me move. I was interested in politics, and that also made me interested in economics because it's often connected with it. And then I met some very exciting economists, one of whom in particular, Sukumar Chakravarti, alas, dead now. He was, when I was in school, Shantiniketan, he was a brilliant student in Calcutta. He would often drop by, and I spent a lot of time with him, and he was trying to persuade me that when I moved to Calcutta, not to continue doing maths and physics and move with him to do maths and economics, which is what I did. But I think the exciting nature of conversation with him and also several other classmates and colleagues of mine made me a very attractive thing. Economics at that time attracted enormously good students, which is a great attraction because, you know, one learned so much from one's classmates. I think the same way as somewhat later on, the technological education will take over, the IITs, which of course has been the basis of the Indian information technology and the really turning of the page of the Indian economy also. But that's happened a bit later. I'm talking now of the early 50s, when I think the correspondingly interesting group were, I think, did either physics or economics. And I moved from one to the other because I was always attracted by intelligent fellow students who could say that, look, what you're saying is absolute nonsense. And it's always fine to argue on that.
We'll get to that, I'm sure, in the course of this hour. I'll remind our listeners that we're speaking with Amartya Sen, the 1998 Nobel Prize-winning economist. Now, as you may not know, one of the aspects of profiles that we have is that we ask our guests to pick some musical selections that we can air that are important to them for one reason or another, and we've asked you to offer several. What would you like us to play?
You know, my taste in music is very diverse. Like my taste in life is very diverse, it's reflected in music too. I think my all-time favorite composer is Mozart. So I would like to, at some stage, perhaps not immediately, play something of Mozart, and I've selected the horn concertos, who I like particularly well, and I have a recording from done by my friend Barry Tuckwell. And I would like at some stage for you to play concerto number 3 from that CD that I brought along with me.
Okay.
But two others in very different line. One, we've been talking about Tagore. And Tagore wrote also a lot of very exciting Bengali songs. And one of them, sung by someone I know well, and in fact distant, in fact related to me too, called Anjana Day. And it's called Amar Novel Abani. Maybe when we come later to it, I will mention what that song is about.
Okay.
But the third with which I might begin is actually sung by my son, Kabir, who had been navigating. He began with interest in classical music, then South Indian classical, Carnatic music, then jazz to blues, and then rap and hip-hop. And this is his hip-hop phase. So we could begin with his slightly funny piece of his. He's very much a believer both in bringing some egalitarian politics into rap, but also rebelling against the nasty language that rap has, hip-hop particularly, has become subjected to. So you find that it's, in terms of politics, it's quite radical, but in terms of language, it's you might even say docile. But there's a slightly funny piece called Liar. And I thought we might begin with that.
I taught Darth Vader how to use the Force. I beat Larry Bird in a game of horse. I helped Lennon and McCartney write those songs. And I warned George Bush that the war was wrong. Showed Diddy and Jigga how to make those hits. Played Jordan 101 and I gave him fits. I took out Tiger on the 18th hole. I told James Brown that he had no soul.
Now, why would you go and do that?
I caged Barry Bonds with a circle change. Told Michael Jackson he was sick and strange. I knocked out Tyson with a punishing blow. I taught Donald Trump how to make that dough. I showed.
All right, we've been listening to the music of Kabir Sen, selected by his father, Amartya Sen, who's here in Bloomington. As part of the Patton Lecture Series, and has graciously agreed to do profiles here on WFIU. Professor Sen, can you tell us why you chose that particular song? Aside from the obvious, it's by your
son. About the paternal connection, yeah. No, I think it's interesting. I like the idea that he has, that these are methods of communication, that hip-hop emerged in parts of New York and in Bronx and Brooklyn. There was a nice piece in the New Yorker on Kabir in the Talk of the Town, which mentioned, discussed that aspect of Kabir's focus. And in a sense, he's trying to get back to is having this communicational angle and also an angle whereby the general thoughts of people on it's not this kind of special swearing outburst that hip-hop often is. So I like that content and some of his music. The Lyre is not a particularly political piece, but on the other hand, it had a feature of the way we think of ourselves sometimes and the way we think of sometimes of others. And so it has a kind of communicational value, and I think it comes out I think it comes out rather well. So I think that was the reason for choosing. Okay. Aside from, as you said, the more obvious one.
Now, we might pause for a moment and take a look at what your kids do. If I understand correctly, you've got an actress, two journalists, and a musician. Is that correct?
Yeah, two journalists in the sense that one is an, well, you can't call her journalist, but she's mostly an editor, my eldest. She edits a magazine called The Little Magazine.
This is in New York?
No, it comes from Delhi.
Oh, from Delhi.
New Delhi. She and her husband, who is actually right, who's a great translator, got recently an award on that. But this is a daughter, Antara. So she was I think she was senior editor of Hindustan Times at one stage, and then moved to starting this magazine with her husband, Pratik. And quite successful. I don't think financially terribly successful. On the other hand, it's beautifully produced, and it has a lot of influence. It's often quoted and so on. And the next one is a film actress called Nandana. I think quite successful in her own field. Based in Bombay, not really Bollywood, but more art movie. She began with a film made by Gautam Ghosh, which actually went to the Cannes, shown in Cannes Festival too. And then the third one is a journalist, Indrani, who is Indrani. And until recently, was working for Newsday, the paper in Long Island. And she then trying to be freelance because she also wanted to cover a bit of the world and so on, rather than just New England. You know, her focus in her work was there, very local. And so she has written about from everything, from politics to cookery in the world, published them in cooking magazines as well as normal journals. And my youngest, Kabir, is the musician whom you heard a few minutes ago.
And he's in Boston?
In Boston, about half a mile from where I am.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, that's
now,
good.
As somebody who is, again, literally born on a university campus, who is the son and grandson of academics, does it cause you any twinge at all that they have not pursued that as a life?
No. I think it would have been great if they did, but it's pretty great that they haven't. I mean, that I have no antecedent view as to what they should be. I have to say, happily, that was two of my parents and grandparents, too. Possibly my grandfather, who was a Sanskrit professor, who wrote actually perhaps the all-time most successful book in English on Hinduism. It's The Penguin Hinduism. It was written in the 50s and it's been still in print. The last edition came out with a new foreword by me. He took a very broad view of Hinduism, very different from the kind of confrontational Hindu political right view of Hinduism. He even discusses how the arrival of Islam enriched some very important philosophical part and creative part of Hinduism. Actually, his original work, after beginning as a classical Sanskrit scholar, was on medieval work on music of Kabir, Dadu, Mirabai, and others, who actually drew on both Muslim Sufi tradition and Hindu Bhakti tradition. And his book is a very definitive book on that, and it differed very sharply from the reading of Hinduism by, you know, like Neeraj Chaudhary or V.S. Naipaul, very different, not to mention the Hindu political right. So it's a novel book. It was novel in the 60s, novel still today, which is why I wrote the foreword. And I think Penguin has tried to sell that in that form, and it's still been very selling. He was very keen on chatting with me on these things. I also told him, of course, that religion didn't move me. Didn't try to move me at all. I mean, he said, okay, fine, it will come with age. And I told him, he said that, you know, it's a great mistake to have religious faith until you can think for yourself. But then when I could think for myself, I seemed to turn not in the religious direction at all. So I told him that. And he said, well, that's fine. I see, because then I suddenly recognized the what his view of Hinduism was, because there's an enormously large literature on atheism, of course. The first of these verses, which is actually quoted in his book, occurs in Rig Veda, 1500 BC, which is meant to be the foundation of Hinduism, asking the question, can we be sure that there is a God who made it all? And if he did make it, does he remember it? And so on. So it begins with a kind of tremendous skepticism. That's not the only verse, obviously, in Rig Veda, but that exists among others. So he said, well, I can understand that you have placed yourself in the skeptical, atheistic, or as they say, lokayat, part of the Hindu spectrum. So I could say that there's no escape. I'm part of the spectrum anyway,
whether you like
no
it or
matter
not,
where I'm located there. So I don't think they tried to influence me much. Both my father and grandfather were very pleased that I went in the direction of academia, but there was no pressure, and there was no pressure in my children's case either. I hope they would agree. And, of course, they haven't gone the way that that I had, so that's fine.
Now, since you bring up the whole question of Hinduism and Islam, clearly those are issues that are front and center, the conflict between those cultures at the time you're growing up. When I look at some of the stuff you've written, I haven't seen so far in the materials I've looked at a reference to Gandhi, to the struggle for independence, and to the struggles between Hinduism and Islam that hit the subcontinent. Can you talk a little bit about...
Yeah, well, first of all, I have written a fair amount on that. My last book, Identity and Violence, the main intellectual exponent of the point of view which I'm trying to present is actually Gandhi. And he's... as the publishers say, he's passing in terms of index reference there. But and actually at the lecture, the Patton lecture for which I'm here in Bloomington, Indiana, the first lecture draws a little on it, and second lecture is very broadly concerned with his ideas, his vision of India and so on. And of course, as you know, he took a view that, I mean, he was very religious himself, unlike me. He was very religious Hindu. But at the same time, thought that he was very, that it's a great mistake to think of the religious identity to be a central one in the context of politics. So the secularism in India, which had long roots, going back, I argue in my book, The Argumentative Indian, which came out in 2002, goes back at least to 3rd century BC to Ashoka, the great Buddhist emperor, who is in fact the first uniting influence in India, being, you know, held an empire which spread across broadly the whole country. He was himself a Buddhist, but very keen on religious freedom and very keen on the state's neutrality to religion and indeed trying to prevent anyone being forced into a thought which he shouldn't have, and very keen on religious dialogue between people. Always with, he also wrote the first something like Robert's Rules of Order about how to conduct an argument. That's 3rd century BC, pretty good. I think the biggest exponent is in historical period is the Muslim king Akbar, the Mughal king, in the 16th century. 1590s is when he's most eloquent on the subject, on the state's duty to be neutral between religions. I think that was one of his points. And the other is the priority of reason over faith. He remained a Muslim, though he was interested in all religions and arranged all kinds of conversation between Hindus, Muslims, and Christians, Jews, Parsis, Jains, and drawing them. Six came under Hindus at that time because they were still not sufficiently separated by the group itself, as well as atheists. He arranged regular meetings in Delhi, in Agra, on that. So Gandhi is, I think, the inheritor of that. Though he himself didn't think that much of Akbar, I think it so happened. But I think it's a Gandhi's mistake there. But I think he is a real inheritor of that thought. The need for the neutrality of the state to religion, which is a very good American thought of 18th century, 1776, right. There's a lot of that. And Gandhi was very much a holder of that. So he was 1931 when the British were getting quite worried about India because the national movement was growing, largely because of Gandhi's leadership And the British made a compromise and hold a meeting in London. 31, he was invited. This is also the occasion when he makes this famous derogatory speech, which is often quoted on landing. He was asked, what did he think of British civilization? I think the Guardian asked him, Manchester Guardian. I think he answered, I think it would be a good idea. I think but he was upset that when the British Prime Minister arranged these things, Gandhi was described as the leader of the Hindus, and was upset about that because that his party that he led wasn't organized on religious lines at all, had members from all parties, and he said he wasn't coming to speak Hindus at all. He was coming to speak for all Indians who want independence from Britain. And he also said that if you have to classify people, let me suggest other ways of doing it. And that connected with my thesis of the book, Identity and Violence, that we all have many identities. And Gandhi's interesting discussion here is to say that, well, you can think of me as in terms of being secular in politics. You can think of me as which group would I most like to represent. I would like to represent 85% of the Indian who are extremely poor and who are often starving and hungry. That's the group I'd like to represent rather than the Hindus, even though I happen to be Hindu in my religion. And he also said there's another way of classifying is gender, men and women. Now, the only member that you've invited here is with a woman, is Sarojini Naidu, who was elected to be president of Congress, the party Gandhi led in 1925. This, I might say, was 50 years before any British political party had a woman leader. Politeness prevents me to say when that happened in America. But Gandhi was very proud of Sarojini Naidu being Congress president. And he said that, you know, told the British Prime Minister that if you think of it differently, you can think of Sarojini Naidu as representing 50% of Indians, namely 50% of Indians happen to be women. And therefore, it is, you have to recognize that when it comes to religious, our religion, that's not a good way of defining our political terrain. I think that is the central idea of my book, In Identity and Violence. And I think its manifest implications are tremendous, whether you talk about the crisis in the Middle East today or the complete confusion that has been created in Britain and in Europe with multiculturalism, which emphasizes not the freedom to choose your religion, freedom to pursue your lifestyle, but freezing people into the community or culture to which they were born. It is the kind of imprisoning them in the past, about which actually Tagore wrote very eloquently too. So Gandhi and Tagore are very present in my work. Gandhi, in these works, even more than Tagore, though in my past work, you're quite right, Tagore is much more important than Gandhi.
I'll remind our listeners that we're pleased and delighted to have Amartya Sen in the studios with us, the 1998 Nobel Prize winner in economics. And as always, on Profiles, we ask our guests to offer some musical selections to reflect their interests. We played earlier some music by your son. What should we feature as our second selection?
Well, I think, as I mentioned briefly, that I would like a Tagore song. And it's a slightly intriguing song. It's called Amar Navala Bani, What I Have Not Said. It's about, the message is about that. And it's sung by Anjana Day, who is a relation of mine also, but also someone I know well. And she sings it beautifully, so I would suggest that song, Amar Navala Bani, to be sung now.
Amar Navala Bani Bhanu Jamini Majhe Amar Navala Bani Bhanu Jamini Majhe
And that was the second of our selections offered by our guest on Profiles today, Our guest is Amartya Sen. And again, perhaps you could remind us, why did you take this second selection of Tagore's music?
Well, first of all, I like Tagore's songs very well, and I think it's very nicely sung here. Also, I think his messages are terribly important. This particular one is a somewhat complex song, which I chose mainly because it sounds, well, again, I recognize the Bengali word won't mean much to you. What I didn't manage to say is quite an important thought.
It's true.
Affects our life all the time.
It will affect
almost
me at the end of this program.
Almost as much as what we did manage to say.
Yep. When this hour is over, it's true. I'll be asking myself, what didn't I ask him? So I'll have to listen to that song and get some more information. Let's talk a little bit about your work, and please, only in the most sort of layman's terms, since I am not well-versed in mathematical logic and that sort of thing in economic terms. But I would like to ask how you got into this sort of aspect of economics that deals with famine, with social inequality, with gender questions, gender rights, and that sort of thing. What drew you to that aspect of economics? And in a way, you were kind of a trailblazer in the 60s and 70s in those fields.
Well, I wouldn't claim to be trailblazer at all, but if anyone thought there was any of it was any good, that would be great. No,
But a trailblazer in the sense that when you were working with Joan Robinson, for example, you were finding it difficult to
Yeah, Joan didn't think much of this anyway. Yeah. She was very interested. Joan Robinson was a great influence on my life in the sense that I loved her. She was a great teacher, and she was a great human being. I thought her economic leadership was entirely wrong, I personally thought. I mean, she was a woman, but took very little interest in any of the women's issues, gender, feminism, none of that. And in fact, it would be regarded that, as many women intellectuals did at that time, as a complete mistake. She was in the left of, very much left, but really regarded as a very much a growth person, wanted to maximize economic growth, thought it was a great mistake to go into social security and so on when you are poor. In fact, criticized Sri Lanka for trying to taste the fruits of a tree without growing the tree. So it took a very kind of hard-headed, often associated with right-wing view, but it's not a right-wing view. It's a kind of hard-headed economist view.
Right.
That if you get your economic growth right, everything else would be okay. I thought that was wrong. It so happened I didn't also agree with her work on growth and growth generation and capital theory. But I disagreed at two different levels that as to whether growth is what really, I mean, obviously it's very important, but whether that's what really should concentrate on, especially since that can't be what we're seeking. That lovely statement of Aristotle in Nicomachean Ethics at the beginning of it, that wealth is... it cannot be what we are seeking, for it is merely useful and for something else. And I think that's a good economic theorem.
That's a good economic theorem.
Well, it's certainly a great economic wisdom. But secondly, I also disagreed also the way she characterized growth theory. But on the other hand, I got so much out of the dialectics of arguments and conversation with her. Very fine influence on me.
What is it that brings you, though, to these questions of what might be termed now social justice in economics? Was it this upbringing of yours, or is there something that nudges you that way?
Well, I think some of it was certainly upbringing. Some of it was certainly connected with Tagore. Some of it was connected with my interest in you see, among the figures that interested me most when I was very young, well, there was Aristotle, of course, a kind of all-time favorite of most people, I guess. I was quite interested in Kautilya, 3rd century, actually 4th century BC, Indian political economist. He wrote the first book called Economics, Arthashastra. But he took a fairly, what I would call a reactionary view, very much a non-egalitarian view, very keen on efficiency and not at equity. On the other hand, it's lovely to read the fact that he's all the time discussing distributional issues, and yet not, you know, there's a lovely song, of Baul song, that I want to jump into a river without wetting my feet. And it's a bit like that. He jumps into that equity territory without wetting his feet in it. And so that interested me. Then I was interested in the politics of Karl Marx, John Stuart Mill, both of whom I found interesting in that own way. John Stuart Mill was the first writer to write about the issue of women's deprivation with a kind of, I mean, really profound insight. His book on the subjugation of women was, I think, a terrific contribution in the mid-19th century. Marx's thing, also the class perspective of the, between rich and the poor and the workers and others, is again a great insight. And of course, my favorite economist has always been Adam Smith. And contrary to the common image of Adam Smith, that he was only concerned with the market economy, he was also very concerned with morals and society. He thought of his book, Wealth of Nations, for which he's mostly remembered now, to be elaborating a small part of his bigger book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And that's really where we discuss the issue of how in society we live together. We have to think about each other and so on. So all these had quite a bit of influence on my thinking. And since I was concerned also with politics and India's poverty and I was left of center myself in politics, though always very keen on democracy as a way of dealing with it, never been tempted by the idea that somehow you could trade off democracy for the sake of equity, because that seemed to me to actually kill off the most valuable instrument we have to pursue equity and give everyone the freedom that would come, because political freedom is very central to all other kinds of freedom. So the compromise that I emerged took me naturally to being, I was not anti-mainstream in some ways, and often I'm asked the question, given the fact that I've often had heterodox view, how has the, why had the establishment been so tolerant of you? And, you know, it could be argued. I've been president of the American Economic Association, of the Indian Economic Association, of the International Economic Association, and the Econometric Society. I mention them not as achievement of glory, but as people saying, well, if all these establishment organizations thought so well of you to choose them to be president, then you couldn't really be a radical thinker. And at some level, I'm not, in the sense that I really don't think that the methodology of economics was mistaken because it got the tools mixed up, which is often the view, and very much Joan Robinson's view. And that view of the Cambridge, I knew very much that. It was more the view that was asking the wrong question. So I was very concerned with asking the right question, concerned with distribution, equity, poverty, gender difference. And the gender thing taught me another thing in the context of studying a group that has been perpetually deprived for a long, long time, namely women, even in situations in families which are quite rich. You know, even if you take Victorian England, men being encouraged to do oil painting while women are encouraged to do watercolor. And so there's a perceptible glass curtain which divides. And that gives you a great insight as to how inequality often survives by making allies out of the deprived, because they come to regard that as their natural station in life, anything else being unnatural. I mean, after all, there's no one as eloquent on the subject of why quote-unquote masculine women should be dismissed as the Queen Victoria, a very successful woman in her own right, but completely dismissing the cause of people who were writing, you know, well before that. England has a great tradition on that. Mary Wollstonecraft, writing in, say, 1792, Vindication of Rights of Women, I think is one of the all-time classic books. If I had to choose all-time classic books that have moved me, Mary Wollstonecraft, a Vindication of the Rights of Women certainly would be one of them. Hmm. Oddly enough, I'm teaching a class in Harvard this year on rights and liberty and social choice, in which that is one of the texts we use. So I think that indicated to me what there was in common between inequalities connected with gender and inequalities connected with class, with nationality, and with, you know, rich and poor countries, and the digital divide and all the other divides that we can talk about. So I've been feeling I wanted to raise questions rather than change basically the methodology. I think I'm very much an Adam Smithian, and a whole lot of traditional economics, even so-called neoclassical economics. I didn't find that the technology, I have got very little grumbling about. Well, I have some grumbling about the technology, obviously. Any technologist would have, and I am that too, in at least some of my time. But I thought the main problem was that we had to ask much broader questions than they were asking. So I rebelled against the traditional economics in a somewhat different way than others who thought that, what went wrong is the tool of analysis went wrong. I always found it difficult to think that somehow what the poor in the world is waiting for is a better method of analyzing capital theory, which is what I was being told again and again in Cambridge, England of my time. Rather, that people are not talking about poverty, and that's what we ought to talk about. So that's, I'm glad you asked the question, but I think that's the answer I would tend to give.
All right. And there, I'm again thinking of Tagore's line of what I didn't say, what we didn't ask, because amazingly we're out of time already. We have one last selection to play, and I won't say we've saved the best for last because I don't want to denigrate your son or Tagore, but we have your favorite composer to get to.
Well, it's Mozart, actually. I have to confess that if I had to choose one composer in all Western, Eastern music put together, I think probably it would be Mozart.
And what's the attraction?
What's the attraction? I find it very lively. I find it very energetic. I mean, I know that others like Vivaldi also has that. You can see the reaction of the children who go around excited, dancing around while you're playing the Four Seasons. But I think Mozart I've always found strangely moving, even when I didn't know very much about him. And I found that whenever I was listening to music without knowing who they were, I was invariably attracted towards Mozart. I like the Horn Concerto. There are so many different, the range is so enormous. But the Horn Concertos I like tremendously. And I was very lucky when I was many years in London. My neighbor was Barry Tuckwell. Barry is a great horn player. And this is, I thought I would select Concerto number 3, and particularly the bit on Allegro, which is lively and inspiring. And you can judge for yourself.
Our guest on Profiles today has been Amartya Sen, the 1998 Nobel Prize-winning economist. Professor Sen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Will. I'm very grateful for giving me the chance to speak with you.
It's our pleasure. I'm Will Murphy. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in September of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blackland-McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.